Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to today's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire. I'm your host, John Still, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Lindsay Rountree, our COO. Lindsay, welcome.
She's gone.
I'm so sorry. I'm lovely to be here. I was thinking about your legs.
I'm so sorry. Wow,
oh, I thought it was going to be job title thing. No, it was the legs.
It was the legs. I walked in and you had trousers out and I just couldn't. And everyone said, no, keep your shorts on.
And now I'm here in shorts.
Anyway, it's lovely to be here. I'm sorry about that intro. I just corpsed for no reason.
Right.
It was a great reason, actually. But carry on.
My legs are a great distraction to everyone around. I'm also joined by the slightly more sensible Rachel Smith, our CEO.
Good Lord, John, don't say that. I'll do something stupid now. Yes, thank you very much. Delighted to be here. Happy to see your legs, John.
Here again. You're welcome, world. It's a hot day and I'm wearing shorts and, you know, the video podcast, it's, you're welcome, audience. We're delirious, to be honest. I'll put that into my introduction. We are going to talk about Netflix's short form ambitions. We are going to talk about Sky's purchase of ITV. But the reason we're delirious is because we are still pretty much just back from ATS Singapore, which is, Rachel, you and I have been on the road for about a month. Lindsay, you were over in Singapore and we've just got back. And the delirium this morning is due to travel. But we'll do the big stories before we dive into our analysis of ATS Singapore. I will kick us off with Netflix. Netflix has agreed licensing deals with Penske Media, BuzzFeed Studios, Condé Nast, Hearst and People Inc. for short-form video, launching on August 3rd across the US, Canada, UK, Ireland, Australia and New Zealand. Short-form is defined as between 2 and 20 minutes, and this move comes on the back of YouTube actually overtaking Netflix in daily viewing time, with TikTok also closing the gap. Lindsay, what does short-form video bring to Netflix?
What does it bring to Netflix? I think it's one of those things of what it thinks it's going to bring versus what it might bring could be two very different things. And I feel like they're doing this because of YouTube and because of TikTok. And specifically, YouTube is now the most watched source of content on connected TVs. So that's huge. Something like Netflix, like they used to be the owner of that, and now YouTube are taking over. But YouTube have this endless arm of content creation. They've got an endless stream of content creators that can produce anything and do produce anything at the drop of a hat. Doing the Netflix route of partnering with premium publishers is a very interesting way of entering into the short form space, and it will help maintain a premium quality to the content that it's producing. But I question how, from a user perspective, what that might then look like. They're going alongside this, they're going into vertical video. Apparently they're already in vertical video. I didn't realize this because I don't watch it on a phone. I watch it on a television. But I also, you know, I'm an ad funded subscriber. What will my home screen look like? Will it be filled with short form content alongside normal content? I'm questioning kind of what that will look like from a user perspective. Already there are, like, they've got these kind of like mini documentaries that keep flashing up. There's one about the Myrtle murders in the US. It's like a 30 minutes or 20 minute like verdict type thing. And I haven't watched it because I like to binge on 4+ hour stuff rather than just 20 odd minutes. I'm not a short form person. So they're not targeting me necessarily, but maybe they should be, because I would love to know what the demographic is versus the demographic of people watching YouTube, like what the difference is. I get they need to compete or feel they need to compete. Do they need to compete? I guess so. But I guess there's obviously questions around it from an advertiser perspective as well. But I suppose from a user perspective, they're obviously launching it in the English speaking markets with very much North American publishers. Will they then do the same thing with Australia, New Zealand and UK publishers as well? Will there be a similar sort of short form deal with them? I'd love to see what that looks like. Because I'd argue on that perspective, because it sounds like it could be sort of quite news focused, in which case they're probably more competing with the likes of Instagram and TikTok rather than YouTube and TikTok. I don't know. There's lots of different questions that it raises, least of all what it means from an ad sales perspective, because I feel like it will raise questions around, will an advertiser choose to go to them alongside YouTube and TikTok, or will Netflix still be very much a premium environment and that means expensive environment? there's a lot, obviously there's a brand safety aspect. So you are, you've got logged on users in a brand safe environment. There's lots to be said for targeting those people in a short form capacity. And also you haven't got the problem of like, what am I appearing alongside? Because you'll be appearing alongside curated premium. Curated premium Netflix content rather than it honestly could be anything that's been labeled as XYZ. There'll be a lot tighter controls on that, I would imagine. But I just question, if I were an advertiser, would this be attractive to me? It would if it was the same price as TikTok and YouTube, but it's not going to be, right? So I don't know if I would find that particularly useful. Well, I suppose it depends on what my budgets are. I don't know. There's lots of queries around it.
Oh, there's, I think, a huge amount of questions that we could go into about this. Like, my big one is just why? And I know that we're getting to the bottom of it, but it's moving into that short form, like you say, vertical. Like, are people watching vertical on the home screen? Are they watching on, like, on the big screen?
I mean, it's, you know, to me, it seems like a confused proposition.
Completely.
Yes, it does.
I don't understand if this is a strategic approach, feeling as though they've got to be competitive with the heavyweights of short form video, so social media platforms and social media channels. So is it a sort of a play to make sure that they're visible and competitive in that environment, whether they're looking to really get, you know, market share away from those big social media platforms and YouTube or not? Do they just want to be able to pick up a similar demographic in terms of audience? And if that is a strategic positioning, well, then what does that mean for Netflix as a platform? Because what does the home screen look like in a living room environment or any other kind of environment that isn't a mobile phone? And then, as you mentioned, Lindsay, if it's drawing something like news into the mix and perhaps sort of, you know, short form news documentaries of 20 minutes, 30 minutes, that kind of stuff, the sort of stuff that you'd see on CNA or, you know, CNN or Bloomberg or something like that, then does that turn it into a media platform instead of a TV broadcaster or a streaming TV provider? So that's where it seems confusing to me from a strategic perspective.
Yeah.
And then from a financial point of view, I'm not sure I can entirely understand it either, because isn't your ad sales, your ad funded model based on premium content, premium prices for premium content against a premium audience? Again, you're kind of slightly confusing the proposition now. So are you trying to draw a different demographic and a different audience in that are more social media platform oriented? Mm. Are you trying to just expand your audience? Okay. But then are you still able to sort of sell them to advertisers as a premium audience? Because is that a premium audience if actually you're going after a TikTok audience who are typically younger, probably don't have the same spending capacity, probably don't have the same lifestyle habits? So exactly what are you pushing to those users? A lot of confusion is the way that I would interpret this.
Yeah, and will you price it differently from the rest of the inventory, or will you pull it together? What does the publisher get out of this? Like, is there a licensing agreement in place? Like that? Yeah. I don't see anywhere they disclose what the publisher will get out of it. Mm. Will they get a share of the ad revenue, or will they get a licensing deal? And also, if you look at the kind of the type of content, or the way they're doing it, not the type of content necessarily, but this is actually kind of a really cheap way for them to do business, because Netflix, and Netflix aren't alone in this, all the different streaming platforms that rely heavily on documentaries. And I love a documentary, so I watch them all. Whenever a new one comes out, I'm right there watching a documentary. But they're so cheap to produce, so cheap to make versus, say, I don't know, Stranger Things, for example.
Yeah.
The more of that they can get, and the more they're actually, and by licensing these premium publishers to produce content for them, that, and they get ad revenue for the publishers doing that, that's a win-win for them. It's a content arbitrage play almost, because they're not producing the content themselves, not creating it themselves, not putting any money into creating it. The publishers are doing that for them for whatever fee, whatever that looks like. And Netflix will be able to get ad revenue, and also probably a different audience, more logged in users, a whole different first party data set off the back of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's hit the nail in terms of my question of why.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
Increased revenue.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. So exactly that, John. I think the answer to the question, why are they doing this, is they're obviously looking for fresh revenue somewhere. Mm. And whether that's building out, you know, the ad opportunities, or whether that's trying to entice more subscribers onto the platform is another matter. But and I can see the sort of macroeconomic trends that are pushing them in that direction. Cost of production is really high, as you said, Lindsay. And also, the way that we consume content, even in a premium stream TV environment like Netflix, has changed dramatically since Netflix has been around. So they're talking about lots of issues around the amount of time that it takes them to produce original series. So even when they produce an original series and have another season or another season beyond that, because there's so much time in between production schedules, the cost of production, often people drop off. So they watch the first season of something, think it was great. And even though, oh yeah, a Netflix original, there's a second season. How do you actually discover that second season's coming or that it's even available? Like unless you are picking it up on other sort of media broadcasting news channels, you've kind of got to be in Netflix to be scrolling through going, oh, there's another season available of X.
Two and a half
Y.
years after the first season.
Exactly. Yeah. So I can see how, you know, the metrics of that are certainly not feeding into an environment where most broadcasters, content providers, media owners and social media platforms are relying mostly on speed and scale. And that is obviously, I think, disadvantaging Netflix in the modern, you know, sort of ecosystem of how we consume content.
Yeah.
I can see how somewhere around the brainstorming table at Netflix this makes total sense to them, but I think just from a consumer product, it's a bit confusing. And I guess we wait to see what it looks like from a financial point of view.
And like, I pay for Netflix and I have no choice but to pay for Netflix. Mm. I pay the cheaper version for the ad-funded model. I moaned about this on the podcast last week about them not being able to access any of that content in other countries. Very annoying.
Yes,
but
I find that irritating.
I do have to pay. I haven't got to pay for TikTok.
No.
It's a free platform to use. Same with Instagram.
Exactly.
And YouTube, I can pay if I want to, but I haven't got to pay to access any of that content. So I've got to pay to see this premium content.
Which is a bit weird, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the whole idea behind, you know, Facebook launching a subscription service. Like, who the hell is going to pay for Facebook? And also, when I first read it, I thought, yeah, this just doesn't excite me at all because I'm not that interested in short form videos, reels, videos. I mean, even social media, I've gotten totally bored of that now. I'm like, there's a couple of comedians and comedy videos, as you all know, because I share them widely.
Every time you see one, you share
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah. I'm like, ting. And that's about it. I don't, you know, whereas I could have disappeared into an Instagram, you know, hole about a year ago from scrolling, it doesn't hold my attention for longer
totally
than 5 minutes
I totally agree with
anymore.
You. I'm going to the
so
same
dull.
Thing.
Yeah, it's
I
so
used
dull.
To see something long form and go, oh, that looks good. I'm going to save that for later. And I have a little folder that I save all my Instagrams that I want to watch later. Yeah. And now I've got this huge list and I just, I can't be asked.
Can't get through
cannot
it.
Cannot be asked to watch it.
Can't
watch
get
this.
Through it.
Yeah. I get bored after a minute and that says a lot about my attention span, but
well,
still.
But and also you'll be indicative, Lindsay, of all of us, right? So again, are they strategically preparing themselves for even a streamed TV content world where a proportion of the audience is much younger, they've got completely different attention habits, completely different consuming habits, and maybe they think they are actually going to make some headway into getting some audience from YouTube, but I don't know. It's also, just because you can compete doesn't mean that you have to. Surely you could just keep doing what you are already doing, but even better.
I was going to bring that up, like the homogenous nature of every platform now. It's ridiculous. Everyone is doing the same thing as everyone else. YouTube wants to go into long form. Netflix wants to go into short form. Disney has a deal with UGC creators now to have vertical video on the platform. Like, it's that question of just having to play in every playground, be in everyone's pocket. It's like, it's tricky. And for me, it dilutes the premium nature of Netflix. It really does. I don't want to flick on my CTV, go onto Netflix and just be fed another stream of garbage. Like, I take a lot of time choosing what to watch, but I really enjoy the premium side of it. So maybe.
Yeah. If you're right, if it gets mixed up with the long form stuff, I'm going to get really wound up
by it.
I'm already super annoyed where this and all platforms suggest things to me that I have already watched.
Yep.
Why do you do that?
Yes.
I've watched
this.
You've got
the capability
not to do that. You can see that I've watched this. So stop serving me things. You might like this. Yeah, you know what? I did like it 2 years ago when I watched it. And you should know that. That really annoys me. And just the kind of the general, the home screen changes, layout, all that kind of stuff. If you're now going to, if short form content is going to infiltrate the other stuff that it already annoyed me with, I might.
When I open the YouTube app, the first thing that comes up is shorts, and automatically it's kind of pushing you into the scroll. If Netflix does the same when you put your TV on, like it's gone.
I'll find something else. There are enough other places to go and find content.
Yeah, it's, you know, maybe.
Hello, Apple TV, which will be the next, I think, logical move for most Netflix viewers if that environment becomes, you know, tainted by, or it just becomes an unpleasant user experience.
Yeah.
Agreed. But no, it's yeah, we'll see how it comes in and what it does to Netflix's viewership and ad sales as well. I think it's a really interesting one. Mm. We're going to stick with TV, and this is a really big one. ITV has sold its media and entertainment arm to Sky for $1.6 billion. The combined Sky and ITV entity would command over 70% of the UK TV advertising and aims to compete with global streamers, although regulators may force Sky to give up its third-party ad sales business, which is very interesting. Rachel, what does this deal mean for the UK TV ecosystem?
So I think, you know, representing 70% of the advertising opportunities available across UK TV is enormous. So I think in the first instance, it represents an enormous amount of consolidation in terms of ad-funded TV. I never think that deals of that size and consolidation of that nature is necessarily a good thing, certainly not for consumers. Like, the danger is that, again, it creates more homogenous content. You stop, you know, you lose perhaps the originality of ITV. And, you know, because when it first started as a TV broadcaster, part of its remit was to produce, you know, a sort of original, unusual quality content. And I wonder where that will go, what the departure from that might look like as a result. And then I also think that where there might be some upsides from a sort of advertising point of view, okay, perhaps this leans into growing some sophistication around CTV in the UK, because does it deliver the promise of better quality programmatic being bought and sold and traded over some sort of slightly more homogenized inventory? I still think that's not terribly straightforward though either. Like, I think that will actually require quite a lot of on the ground practical aligning of, you know, sales and measurement systems that are used internally and, you know, audience data. What happens to audience data? Are you able to seamlessly, you know, bring those two, you know, potential reservoirs of audience data across Sky and ITV together? That's certainly not going to be a straightforward thing. So maybe the direction of travel, if the deal goes through, maybe the direction of travel is potentially more sort of programmatic TV ad-funded opportunities, and so better for the programmatic TV ecosystem. But I don't think that's going to be instant. So I think that's going to happen over a period of time. I think the other thing as well is that it's yet another story. So I understand the economic drivers. It's another story of more traditional, shall we say, players trying to compete with giant tech platforms and social media platforms and YouTube, of course. And I understand the drive to do that, but I still think that there really isn't anything directly comparable to YouTube. It is enormous. It's such a vast repository of content that the point of it is not to get to the bottom of all of that content or surface all of that content, in the same way that the point of strong TV broadcasters and content owners is completely different, a bit similar to Netflix. You don't go to Netflix just to see shit telly. In fact, you go to Netflix to see good quality television and to discover something premium and of really quality content. And arguably, that's what people go to ITV for as well. Like, it might not be, sure, that's where you're going to find Love Island. Don't even know if that's where you find Love Island, but yeah.
Correct, it is.
There we go. Yes, okay, well done. Me. So sure, that's where you're going to find Love Island, but you're also going to find some other pieces of really good quality. That tells you what I think about Love Island, of really good quality TV content. And it goes hand in hand with the brand that they've built and grown over, you know, decades and decades. And I just don't think you really want to be the next YouTube if you're that. However, I do understand that being different to YouTube and being an independent broadcaster and a creator of, you know, original content is a really expensive business. So, of course, you have to be following the money. And if the money is Sky popping around to your house going, we'll acquire you for $1.6 billion, then it's pretty hard to say no to that. But I don't really know what it does to them, even as a combined entity, in terms of real competitors to incumbents and those that are funded by giant tech platforms, because effectively that's what we've got in YouTube, don't we? Funded by Google. Mm. So, yeah, it's And I imagine it's kind of tricky news for all of our friends at ITV. There'll be lots of concern about what that actually means practically. So how do we reduce management costs and, you know, what happens to various job roles and functions across the piece? Like I said, I can see the economic drivers, but I'm not sure that the outcome will really be that positive for both the consumer market and also for, you know, the ad tech industry and the ad business.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you reckon?
Yeah, there's so much that Rachel said there that I completely agree with. First of all, like the coming together of the reservoirs, as you put it, like that's going to be impossible. Like the merging of ad tech is going to be really interesting, and the merging of data pools will be fascinating to see how long that takes, because it will take a while. The percentage of ad market is what interests me, because 70% is what has been talked about as being like, that's how much Sky and ITV combined would make up of the CTV ad business. Mm. But that, I think, includes Sky's third party ad business, which includes Channel 5 and Warner Brothers Discovery and whoever else that they have, that they basically manage the ad business for. They have put another source, I think it was DigiDay, said that if you just include Sky's direct business and ITV's, it's 44%. Which shows you what percentage Warner Brothers and everything else makes up in the market. And I think the Sky CEO themselves said that the percentage of total UK ad spend is 6.5%.
Okay.
And that is the number with which they will go to the CMA.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying, if the CMA sees a 70% number, they'll go, well, that's not going to fly.
Yeah.
We can't have you owning that amount of the business. And I think their argument's going to be, we are trying to compete with the entire ad business. Mm. Money is leaving TV to go elsewhere, largely YouTube. I don't think YouTube doesn't sit within the TV ad space in terms of how it's measured and how it's reported on. So that's why they're trying to say, we are a tiny, tiny piece of the entire UK ad business, only 6.5% if we combine. And that's what they're trying to say, like, that's where the growth will be. So that, I think, is very interesting, and how the CMA will look at that. Because also what might happen is they might say that Sky have got to divest their third party ad business, and that Channel 5 and Warner Bros. Discovery and whoever else, I can't remember who else, Paramount, want to say,
will HBO have to go off Max
it, HBO Max yeah. when it comes to yeah they'll have to when it comes to the UK it's already in the UK they'll have to go off and fly the nest and kind of run their own ads business. I feel sorry for Channel 4 in all of this, because Channel 4 is kind of the sort of lone independent. They've been struggling so much over the years. Mm. They really struggle with original content, and that then makes them struggle with their ads business. They're not what they used to be, and this just makes things probably more complicated for them. Or it presents an opportunity, I don't know, like to show the independence of British TV. Because the other thing that's interesting about this is the obviously ITV Studios aspect of this, because that will be completely separate from this new broadcast business. And people don't realise how much content ITV Studios produces for stuff outside of ITV, like BBC, all different channels. Like ITV like own pretty much all the studios in this country, and so there'll be so much content that they can now sell elsewhere. I don't know, because obviously ITV is still a public service broadcaster. Sky is not. They've been battling for years to be classed as one, and they're not allowed to be. So whether I don't know what the coming together of these two will mean from that perspective. But also, does it mean that ITV Studios can now sell their content to the highest bidder? Do they have to give Love Island to ITV anymore? Do they have to give I'm a Celeb to ITV? Or can they say, well, actually, Channel 5 have bid more than you, so we're going to get to Channel 5 instead? Like, that's going to be very interesting to look at what that looks like as well, because that then has an impact on the ads business, because ITV has a huge source of revenue from things like Love Island. If they aren't able to broadcast them anymore, it's going to impact Sky massively as well. And I think from a CTV perspective, it could be a good thing for advertisers, but actually it could also be a terrible thing. And it's going to be remains to be seen what that looks like.
Surely Love Island's about to be cancelled the same way that MAFSA was.
Well, we're getting
we're getting there. Yeah, we're getting into that
probably.
But I know what you mean. Any blockbuster, yes, quite frankly. I think the public service broadcasting angle is really interesting. I didn't think about that, actually. There's obviously going to have to be some kind of, I mean, what is that going to look like in a combined entity with, you know, with a media owner that is not very much not a public service broadcaster? What does that mean for the standards that they need to meet? What does that mean for the mix of programs that they need to show, etc.?
Exactly.
So there's obviously quite a few things that still need to be ironed out.
Yeah, it's a theme with our stories today. There's many questions being asked,
definitely,
rather than answers being presented. I remember when Channel 5 bought Neighbours. That was a...
Oh, it was a big deal.
Pivotal moment everyone's lives here in the UK.
It really was. I was kind of already out of the loop of watching it by then anyway. I think I was, well, maybe not. I'd almost outgrown it a bit.
Yeah.
I'm a BBC Neighbours person all the way.
Oh, I see. Absolutely. Yeah.
It was always BBC Neighbours, ITV Home Away, and that's the way it worked.
Yep.
And then it all got confused. ITV got Neighbours as well.
Yeah.
And Home and Away. So on documentaries, I'd highly recommend the Kylie documentary on Netflix.
I haven't watched that yet. It's very good. I do want to watch that, yeah.
And it'll give you a bit of like Neighbours nostalgia.
Okay, good. I do enjoy Neighbours nostalgia.
Haven't watched it since Toadie drove off a cliff.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know who Toadie is.
Toadie? Toadstool?
We all stopped.
Jared, Rebecca, come on now.
We all stopped watching Neighbours years
ago. Long before we did, yeah.
Long before everyone else, everywhere else in the world did.
Yeah. On his wedding day, drove off a cliff. His last words were, kiss me, wife.
Oh. Did you drive off the cliff with her?
Oh, yeah. It was with...
Anyway, we've gone on a tangent. The batteries are dying.
Why did they do that? Yes, okay, let's crack on. I'll need to understand why
they did
that.
We'll pick up this later. So, yes, post-ATS Singapore Delirium, we had a really successful event, over 1,000 guests. It's, you know, a huge event for us. It's great to be over in the region and, yeah, generally one of the highlights of my year. But, yeah, Lindsay, you were back for the first time in 3 years. What were the trends and topics? What did you love? Tell me about it.
I loved everything.
Good.
I loved it. Like, it was so good being back there after a sort of a brief hiatus of 3 or 4 years, and just seeing how it's grown and how kind of just the general atmosphere there was just so lively and so much chatter, and there's so much emphasis on everyone showcasing what they're doing, like probably more so any other event that we run than any other event that I visit generally as well. Like, that is a really, really kind of great place for everyone to kind of get together, and the networking is such an important part of it. But the content as well, I thought the content was absolutely excellent. We had some fantastic speakers talking about some really interesting things. Things that stood out for me were omnichannel came up a lot, kind of our understanding omnichannel. We had out of home conversations, we had retail media conversations, but they all tied back to what it looks like from an omnichannel perspective and how you're bringing those things in together. And AI came up, and what I always love about AI conversations, wherever you go in the world, everyone kind of goes to a panel that's not about AI, and then the panelist or moderator will at some point go, well, we've got 28 minutes, I haven't mentioned AI yet, let's talk about AI. And it was no different there as well. Yeah, like, it's like, correct. How we haven't talked about AI yet, how funny. But of course, it's because AI is underpinning it everywhere. You don't haven't got to mention it anymore, really, because it is kind of underpinning it. Having said that, the AI panel was really interesting too.
It was great.
And we had some great case studies about how AI is being implemented and kind of how it's being used from a creative perspective, from a kind of just running general campaigns perspective. And that, I think, was very, very interesting, especially because it's used differently in APAC, it feels, to how it's being used over here. And so seeing kind of where they're using it, how they're using it, the success they're getting with it, the different types of companies that are using it in different ways, I thought was really fascinating. Because there's a lot to learn, I think, over here as we kind of get to grips with it a bit more. And so that I found very, very interesting. But just generally, like I said, the omnichannel was a big theme, but it felt like omnichannel data and measurement were key things that just kept coming up in every conversation and are still fundamental to everything we're doing. And they were, just kind of really kind of intrinsic into everything, and as they always are and should be. And also the AI thing, lots of reminders that people are better and now cheaper. So you can't have one without the other.
Yes, that's a good point, actually. I was really pleased at the fact that there wasn't overusage of the word agentic. I feel like
people were
not using that word,
at
least not, without, sort of ascribing a very specific task. Mm. So that was quite heartening because, as you described, Lindsay, I felt like people were talking about practical use and application of AI in a meaningful way, and it was definitely underpinning all the conversations that we're having because it's underpinning our lives, quite frankly. So why wouldn't it be? I have to agree on that front. I loved, you're right, omnichannel was a big theme, and I really enjoyed observing that conversation where we may have sort of 4 or 5 years ago talked about it being an ambition, that conversation has now very much turned to, and this is in fact exactly how many brands and advertisers are doing campaign planning. This is how agencies are organising themselves in order to help brands execute across a whole range of channels. This is what investing across a range of channels should look like. This is what ad tech tools should be used in order to make that possible. So I felt like a lot of the conversations are starting to become very practical.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we've always tried to put a practical lens on everything that we talk about at ATS, but I think there was a lot of that on stage in Singapore this year, backed up by quite a number of case studies from brands and also from agencies. The other thing is I love all the agency folks that we get on stage in APAC. There's some incredibly talented people working in agencies globally, but especially in APAC, and it's fantastic. And, you know, it starts once we really start to get into the pre-ATS conversations and we make connections with all of our panelists to kind of run through what we'll talk about on the day, and you suddenly find yourself having a deep dive on something really technical and specific with an expert from an agency, and you just think there's so much talent in this industry. You know, this is actually, we might only be executing advertising, but we're using a lot of brain power to do that. And that links back to what you said then, Lindsay, too, which is there really isn't any use to any of the AI tools that we're you know, sort of baking into our lives unless we've got some kind of human element engaged in that as well, whether it's oversight or prompting properly or that sort of thing. One of the standouts for me was a case study from Brainlabs Independent Agency, who are helping their clients understand how they're showing up in LLM searches and queries, and also helping them move from traditional search metrics to fresh metrics tricks to make that meaningful and to also convert, to turn it into conversions. And, you know, that was a really good practical case study, and there's going to be some follow-ups on that too, because there's lots of brands in the audience wanting to know more about that.
Yeah.
So that was great. And then, of course, chicken rice. That's ATS Singapore chicken rice. Great. Singapore chicken rice.
Our famous,
it's the highlight.
Yeah. The famous chicken rice. That's right. ATS.
I also felt like there were, maybe if you agree with me, but you had the agency panel at the start of the day, which was agency execs talking about kind of what where they're
independence
going
versus holdcos, what the strategic positioning is.
And there were also lots of agencies on stage, as we talked about, and brands as well, talking about their relationships with agencies. And I felt like there was a lot of conversation around what the future of the agency model looks like, and them trying to understand where they fit in this new ecosystem, this new infrastructure, which I think is very, very interesting. And it's something we're reckoning with all around the world. So hearing kind of what the different approaches to how we play with tech, how we play with people, how we play with our clients, like that felt like a very interesting thread that needs to keep being pulled on.
And also people more willing to talk about and what that looks like from a business point of view and from a financial point of view, like what do the remuneration models look like around that. That was a really fascinating conversation. Lots of agency folks saying their brand clients are still driving them towards kind of, you know, old remuneration models, but those models everyone has accepted has got to change now, because we can all see very transparently the cost of using AI versus the cost of using humans, and understanding how all of that stacks up and how agencies need to be rewarded for the work they're doing in a more transparent way. You know, that conversation is really starting to get very real, live.
Yeah, I totally agree.
That's good.
And I also liked the thing I was looking forward to, which is the conversation between Andrew Casale, CEO and Exchange, and Kieran O'Kane, about the fact that the canarization is going to be so powerful for the APAC market, and the kind of the fragmentation that exists within Southeast Asia is going to be going to work really, really well, and the cost reduction that's going to come with it. That was there was a lot of people very excited to see him on stage, and I think he delivered, and they were very happy with what he had to say.
Absolutely.
How it applies to the region.
Yeah, his first visit to Singapore and to that part of the APAC region. Index have got a big APAC business growing, and I think everybody was really grateful for the visit. Mm. They're always very welcoming of visitors, and I think it was really eye-opening for Andrew to just understand, to see the breadth of the market there. I mean, you know, in terms of people who are prepared to turn up and talk about ad tech, and just to understand what's top of mind. Cost is definitely, I mean, it's important everywhere, but in that region it feels more important than ever, because you're talking about a lot of disparate markets with very different dollar values associated to the cost of advertising. Absolutely. And executing advertising. So DSP containerization is, as Andrew keeps saying, one of the biggest technological advancements since the invention of RTB and programmatic. So it stands to have a really big impact on that region, and it'll be really exciting to see how that unfolds. Mm. One final highlight, Paddle, Team Paddle. We had some...
Didn't make it.
Neither of you were involved in the Team Paddle.
I have to do
a shout out to the fabulous marketing team, and also to Laura on our sales and partnerships team. And we had a great paddle foursome, and I did accidentally whack Laura right in the shoulder with a very hard paddle ball.
Wonderful. So attacking your staff.
That's exactly lovely. Right. I thought HR might have gotten involved in that, but she braved it out. It wasn't personal.
It always is a wonderful trip. We had a great time. It's always about the people. We have great relationships over there. It is such a welcoming and warm event, and looking forward to the next one quick shout out to Chris Muttershead, who I know is listening, maybe mowing his lawn.
Yes.
But yeah, it was... Yeah,
you can join us for the paddle tournament next year, Chris.
We'll open it up to guests. We'll
to have wider, not just the Exchange Wire team.
A paddle invitational.
Oh, my God.
It's gone. It's going. It's
I'm, gonna, not tell, I'm not returning
We're roping you in, Lindsay. We're
I'm
roping
not
you in.
Next year. I'm going to stay at home. Yeah, back at home.
Brill, thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And we will be back next week. Thank you very much.
And goodbye from John's legs.
I don't even know how to respond anymore.
That's brilliant.
You're welcome again. Right.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by Exchange Wire.